G'day, and welcome to the Fasting Highway podcast. I'm your host, Graham Curry, from Perth, Australia. I lost 60 kilos or 132 pounds living an intermittent fasting lifestyle and have successfully maintained that weight loss now for over a year. I wanted to bring this series of podcasts to you to give you an insight into what that journey has been like. I also wanted to give you some information about intermittent fasting, talk to people that are doing it, and bring in some experts in the field, including some leading authors of some great books about the subject. Talk about the highs, the lows, the triumphs, the celebrations, the negatives, the positives, and everything in between. Nothing is a silver bullet, as they say, but intermittent fasting is about the closest thing that you can get to a perfect health plan with a side effect of weight loss. So sit back in the next few weeks and enjoy life on the fasting highway with us. Thank you. G'day, and welcome to the Fasting Highway, and this is episode 12. So today it's my great pleasure to have with me Sarah Cull, and Sarah is a practice nurse from Auckland, New Zealand, and Sarah has been working with obese patients and patients with diabetes too, where the frontline treatment is intermittent fasting, and Sarah has seen some amazing results and documented some case studies, and she recently presented to a doctor's conference on fasting in the South Island of New Zealand. And Sarah's own journey with fasting has been quite remarkable. And here to tell us all about that journey today and the great work that she's doing in the clinic and a bit about her own Facebook group and what Sarah does, thank you for joining us. G'day, Sarah, and welcome to the Fasting Highway. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Graham.
Oh, you're my second Kiwi I've had on the show, so there you go.
Awesome.
Yep. So, Sarah, what we'd like to do here on the Fasting Highway, just give us a bit of your backstory and what led you up to finding out about IF and actually how you did find out about it.
Yeah, so it was a couple of years ago. My youngest baby was about one, and I had a friend that did a lot of keto and did the odd fast. And keto was not really anything I could commit to. I didn't love that. So, but the fasting interested me, and I came across Jyn Stephens with her Delay, Don't Deny book, and had a sort of bit of look through a bit of research and decided that, yes, this was the way to go. So I read her book and started probably even before I finished reading her book, and had phenomenal progress, felt amazing within a couple of weeks.
Yeah, that's amazing. So when you first started, Sarah, what sort of fasting protocol were you doing?
So I started with 16-8, which I think a lot of people do. And I did that for a few weeks, but probably around about the month mark, I found I wasn't really hungry for dinner. So I naturally fell into a lunch and afternoon tea sort of a window. So it was sort of like 11 till 3, something like that.
Yep.
After that first month. And then I just kind of progressed from there. I lost all my weight in the first 8 months. So I lost 20 kilos.
Wow.
Or about 37 pounds, something like that. And then just have kept it off and just kept fasting and feel amazing.
That's incredible. And so what were your sort of food choices like in those early days? Were you eating all the things or were you restricting anything?
No, I never restricted anything. I mean, I wasn't a lifelong dieter. I had done Weight Watchers and I had lost a bit with Weight Watchers and I'd done a couple of sort of diet plans, but I really struggled with the restriction, and I often found that I was so hungry that I'd end up failing at the diet, as you know, a lot of people find. So when I started fasting, I didn't change my diet at all. I simply fasted, clean fasted, and then ate whatever. But naturally that changed. So over time, I'd reach for healthier options. There are a few old faves that they just don't work for me, as in I don't like them anymore, or I just don't, they're not window worthy, you know. So yeah, and just over time things have changed, and of course my portions are a lot smaller than they used to be as well.
Yeah, and that's a natural progression, I think, Sarah, and you probably see that in some of your patients we'll talk about in a minute, is that we get to that stage where we become basically food snobs, really. And I know my taste changed so much from my previous diet when I was obese. So you didn't really have weight issues all your life, so to speak, just sort of crept up on you, and then you found intermittent fasting and got the weight off. But 20 kilos in 8 months is pretty good going. You must have noticed a lot of changes internally. And what about the non-scale victories and health benefits?
Yeah, so one of the big factors for me in wanting to lose weight at that point was that my blood pressure was creeping up, and I've got a family history of high blood pressure, and my sister, who's only 18 months older, is on blood pressure medication, and I didn't want to be on medication so early, and I felt that if I could lose some weight, that hopefully I could, you know, at least delay that. And of course it did. So within, I think it was within 2 or 3 months, my blood pressure was back to normal.
Wow, that's fantastic.
So that was amazing, and that was a big thing for me. But also I had been getting heartburn quite a lot, and that had gone. I had more energy, so I wasn't getting those slumps that you get in the afternoon. Just a clearer head, you know, you just kind of feel better, less bloating, you know, you just feel so good. And I often say this to patients when they're first starting, I say, look, very few people do fasting and then do it well and give up because they feel so good with it.
What about your friends and family and colleagues and so forth? What did they sort of think about you doing intermittent fasting in the beginning? Did you get much kickback from anybody?
Do you know, not really. I didn't say anything for the first week, not even to my husband, but my husband works quite late, and often I used to eat dinner with the kids, so it wasn't anything new to not see me eat when he had dinner. So he didn't really know about it the first week, but I think I lost a couple of kilos in the first week, so I couldn't keep my mouth shut, you know. So, but no, look, I started by, and I always do, I start with the science. So I talk about the insulin and why we don't lose weight with diets. And then I say, so now I do intermittent fasting. And I find that very few people kick back on that, because you can't argue with the science, really. If I said to people I don't eat for 24 hours, well, they'd panic and freak out. But, you know, when you start with the science, they accept it.
Yeah. And so speaking of the science, Sarah, obviously you really understand it. What's your favorite bit of science, and what's a great resource for people to go and look at the science of intermittent fasting when they're beginning?
So I think for people who aren't medical or who struggle with too much medical or science, I actually say Jyn Stevens' books are the best options, because they're such an easy read. She puts all the science into that easy read. So for those people, I send them straight there. When I'm talking to doctors or other medical people, I often send them through to the obesity code or the diabetes code. They're a bit more in depth and a little bit more sciencey, but I find sometimes those medical professionals need that.
Yeah.
And plus that study that came out last year in the New England Journal of Medicine, I like that because it's recent and it's got some good info in it.
Yeah.
So I send people to that as well.
It's about obesity and diabetes in New Zealand, because that's why we really wanted to get you on today. And I know you're doing some great work there. And could you just sort of explain about how obesity and diabetes is going in New Zealand? And is it growing there, or is it like getting worse?
Yeah, so as the most of the OECD, New Zealand has quite a high rate of obesity. Over 30% of our adult population is obese in New Zealand, and that statistic's worse for our Māori and Pacific Island people. So, you know, it is a significant problem, and with that, of course, type 2 diabetes. So, yes, as a lot of the world has found, the developed world, that this is a growing concern. And that was a big thing for me. So when I started fasting, I did it for me and for weight loss. And as I was going through that process for myself, I did a lot more research and study around IF and diabetes, because as a nurse here in New Zealand, I see that all the time. And I've never been really passionate about diabetes, because I always felt it was a disease that we always struggled to get good results with. We, you know, our patients were diagnosed with pre-diabetes, and sometimes they'll lose a bit of weight and starve it off for a year or two, but more often than not, they're then diagnosed as type 2, and over time they generally get worse. Very few people can improve it by a significant amount, and a lot of them end up on insulin. So I never loved that disease, because there wasn't much I could do as a nurse. You know, you could try all the motivating factors in the world, but the reality is that diet and exercise doesn't work. And I sort of knew that without knowing what the answer was.
Yeah.
So when I found fasting, it was different.
And is that a field that you were always in with your nursing, sort of the obesity and that sort of thing? Was that something you moved into?
Yeah, well, I work as a practice nurse. I work in a GP clinic. And so we deal with everything, but a lot of it is around preventative health, heart disease, diabetes, obesity. You know, a lot of our work is around that. So I've always been in that field, but, you know, it wasn't until I discovered fasting that I thought, actually, here's something we can do that will make a huge difference to our patients and, in fact, will treat their diabetes and not just their blood sugars. And, of course, over time, it's proven.
That's incredible. So tell us about how you convinced the actual clinic to get on board with intermittent fasting.
So at the time, I was quite lucky. I was working at a practice that was relatively new with some young forward-thinking GPs. And I just shared the info that I had and said, look, can I get some of my patients on board? And they were keen. I mean, I've been a practice nurse for over 16 years, so, you know, I'm pretty safe with my practice, and I tend to be cautious, and they know that. So yeah, they were keen, and we saw amazing results very quickly. In fact, probably my very first fasting client, he was a newly diagnosed type 2 diabetic. His HbA1c was 100. Which I think in American statistics, that's around 12. And we put him on a fasting plan. We started him on metformin, one of the medications, and we put him on fasting. He fasted, I think he was fasting between 16 and 20 a day. I think he was fluctuating a little. But within 3 months, his HbA1c had halved. So it was down to 48. And you don't see that response with medication alone. So that was really motivating.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And so did you get quite a few patients on this now? What sort of numbers are we talking about, the number of people you guys have been treating now with intermittent fasting through there or New Zealand in general with it?
New Zealand-wide, I think it's still very slow. I only know of about two other practitioners who actually practice and sort of preach fasting. In New Zealand at the moment, but of course we're working to change that.
Yeah.
I now work in a couple of clinics in South Auckland, and South Auckland's very well known for high rates of obesity and type 2 diabetes. So I promote it to everyone.
Yeah, you find with the Maori and Polynesian population, it's much more prevalent obesity and diabetes and that sort of thing.
Absolutely it is, and that's a statistic I would love to change. And I, in fact, work at a marae clinic, so have a very high rate of Māori clients coming to see me, and I'm really quite keen to change that statistic. So, and the thing with fasting, too, is that it's free. And a lot of the population I work with, they don't have a lot of money, you know, so to tell them the traditional diet, actually, it's not achievable. They've still got kids to feed. But to tell them to skip a meal or two, well, they can do that. You know, it doesn't cost them anything. Their kids don't go without. And so that's one of the things I really like about fasting for my clients, is that, you know, they don't have to pay to do it.
Yeah. And the other thing is, in a lower socioeconomic areas, we have that real cheap food that's available where people don't really sometimes have a lot of choice. They can't afford the higher quality food, so they tend to go and buy the cheap stuff from the takeaway shops and that sort of thing. And that's where we get the higher rates of obesity in that, of course. But
So with the GPs, when you're saying they're forward thinking, are these younger sort of GPs or are they sort of all rangers?
So they're all rangers now. And so I've moved on from that original clinic I started in, and I now am in two different clinics based mostly there, and a whole range of GPs that I work with. But again, when you present them with the science, and I now have a lot of case studies that I can share, because of course I've been doing this for a couple of years now, so I've got some phenomenal case studies that I can share with these doctors. So when you show them that and you start to show them the progress with their own patients, you know, they're all on board, and who wouldn't be?
Yeah. Can you share with us a couple of those sort of case, the little synopsis of those case studies, where they're going with them?
Yeah, absolutely. So probably my most recent patient is a 49-year-old. He's been a type 2 diabetic for 15 years. Now, he started fasting with me in January, so he's 9 months now. He was on insulin twice a day, and he was on Galvamet and Glipizide twice a day. So we started fasting. He went pretty quickly to one meal a day, so he does about 20-hour fasts most days. And by June, his blood sugar levels were normal, so we stopped his insulin. And July, his HbA1c was 50, so it was 108 when he started with me, so it had more than halved. And that was the best result he'd had in over 15 years.
Wow.
And when I told him of that result, he actually cried and he gave me a hug and he said he didn't think it was possible.
That's amazing. You're changing lives, yeah, and that sort of thing. But it must be so good for their mental health as well.
Oh, big time. I mean, I think fasting's shown to improve, you know, mental clarity and improve rates of depression and things like that. So that on its own is helpful. But I think when you can show a patient who's been taught all their lives that they'll end up on dialysis, or they've watched their whānau or their, you know, parents or whatever end up on dialysis, and you say, actually, there's a different way for you, I think, you know, that alone, and when they see those results, yeah, absolutely, changes the way they think about their life and their health.
And how do you sort of, say if I'm a person that comes into your clinic now, when you sit down and you explain to them all about intermittent fasting, and there's quite a few people that listen to this podcast that don't really know a lot about intermittent fasting, but they're curious, how would you go mm-hmm. about convincing somebody, and how would you just explain intermittent fasting in a nutshell?
So generally I sort of start off with the information about insulin. So when we eat, we release insulin, and that insulin moves the glucose from our bloodstream into our cells for energy, so our muscles and our brain. And when we don't eat for a period of time, the opposite is true. So insulin's very low, and when insulin's low, your body can then pull stored energy or fat and sort of convert that back into energy through the bloodstream. So I sort of talk to them a little bit about that balance, and there's sort of two food groups. There's the food we eat, or two energy sources, the food we eat, and then there's the stored fats that we store for later. So we sort of talk a little bit about that, and then I go through, you know, I say, look, you think of our ancestors, and we weren't made to eat the way we do. We didn't have constant access to food, you know, early in the morning till late at night is often, you know, when we're eating. So that balance of insulin, high insulin versus low insulin, is really out of whack. So I talk to them a bit about that, and then we sort of look at, say, okay, well, we don't have enforced periods with no food anymore, so we need to enforce those ourselves. And that's where the intermittent fasting comes in. So I keep it very basic, but we sort of cover a little bit of the reason why it works. And quite often I talk about, especially for those who have tried a lot in the past, I'll go over why the calories in versus calories out doesn't work. And you get a lot of sort of light bulb moments when I say, you know, and then you start to get tired and hungry because you don't have enough calories, and they all go, oh yeah, well that happened, you know?
Yep.
So we cover that a bit as well.
So for you personally, when you first started learning about intermittent fasting and you read Jin's books, and we're talking about Jin Stevens here, the New York Times best-selling author of Fast, Feast, Repeat, and also the book Sarah's referring to there, Delay, Don't Deny, which was Jin's first book, which was also the book that I first read and discovered intermittent fasting. And I think we're all pretty grateful for Jin. But sort of when do you say to these people, like, I know what it's like in the Maori and Pacific Island cultures with how much they love food, and for to try and convince them that eating once a day is a good idea, that must be a tough gig at times.
Yeah, and look, there are, you know, for every patient I have an amazing success with, there's at least 5 or 10 who just can't get on board. And that's the reality, I think, of anything. But one of my big things I say to them is, look, you know, they have this beautiful hangi and there's all this amazing food that they cook and they share. If I put you on a traditional diabetes diet, you couldn't have that. You know, you'd be having salad and chicken. So I often say to them, look, you can still have your hangi on a Sunday with whānau, but you need to just make sure you fit in that fast before and that fast after. And I think that's the key here, is that I don't touch their diet, you know, within reason. I try and encourage, of course, healthy options. But the reality is, as we discussed, for many, you know, they eat what they can afford and they eat what's in the pantry, and that's just the way it is. So, you know, I couldn't even tell you what half my case studies eat, because I don't even cover that with them. We just introduce the fasting.
And do you find, Sarah, that once they start getting those results, and in particularly reversing things like diabetes, and I'll get you to talk about that a bit too, about what that process is, as some people listening to this may not understand. But do you find that their family start sitting up and taking notice, or people around them?
Yeah, absolutely. So quite often a partner will get on board. One of my recent clients that I've started with fasting, she's not diabetic, but she's overweight and just wants to lose a bit of weight. So she started and she's seeing some great results, and her partner's just jumped on board and he is a diabetic. So yeah, absolutely. And my husband joined me after about 3 weeks. So he lost 10 kilos with fasting, and he's probably a little bit more flexible than I am now. But, you know, everyone around me fasts. My mum's lost probably about 20 kilos as well. So she fasts and has one meal a day. And I think that's the thing, when people see the success and see what you can still eat as well. You know, we're not talking about salad here. We eat like normal people. We go to a barbecue and we have a sausage and we have dessert. And I think when people see that and see that you still get results, they want in. So
yeah. And life's too short not to have kiwi fish and chips on a Friday night, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's amazing, actually, in New Zealand, I actually know a kiwi lady here who's 75, Sarah, and mm-hmm. she started intermittent fasting after seeing my results with it, and she got on board, and she's reversed her diabetes now, and she's gone back. She was had a lot of problems, and she gone back to being a champion lawn bowler and everything. It's just amazing.
It is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. And so where to from here, Sarah? Do you do a bit of coaching yourself? Do you help people apart from working in the clinics outside of that?
Yeah, so I run a Facebook group for New Zealanders. We've just hit 4,000 members on there now. I try and encourage my patients that I see in person as well to join, just because it's quite a motivating group and I try and keep it really positive in there. So I run that, and that takes a bit of time. I get a lot of messages from that as well. But I do see private clients. So a lot of them I do online, just because I live sort of a bit further south of Auckland, and you know, it's hard for people to travel, and I've got 2 young kids and I'm quite busy, so it's hard for me to travel. This year I presented to the GPCME, so it was a conference for doctors and nurses for the South Island, and unfortunately, thanks to COVID, of course, that was online, so I didn't get to fly down, but I presented to a lot of practitioners online on fasting.
Wow.
So my idea is to spread the news. I really want to get this sort of a bit more mainstream. I want people to, especially medical people, to understand that diabetes isn't that long-term progressive disease that we were taught. It's in fact very reversible.
Yeah, so what
So,
is that process, Sarah? Can you just describe the process of reversing that diabetes with that weight loss? What happens?
Basically, when we start the fasting, I almost always start people on 16:8 just for compliance. So, just to get them used to fasting, it's not too hard to sort of skip breakfast and get that 16 hours in. So, that's where I start my patients. Some of them will see some really good and quick success with that. I've got a few people who have really impressively reduced their HbA1c with their diabetes with just 16 hours. So if they're getting really good success, I just leave them like that and we just tweak as we go along. But there are a lot of patients who are quite overweight and have been for a long time and who have had diabetes for a long time. So for those people, often they need that one meal a day as opposed to the 16 hours. So pushing them up to 20, 21 hours fasting a day is where I like to get them. So we start off and I just sort of check in with what medications they're taking and make sure we're sort of doing that safely with the fasting, make sure they're not taking insulin when they're not eating and those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And we just keep an eye on things.
Could you tell people too, Sarah, you start off at the 16 and 8, and why it's important to sort of move up towards that 20 so we get into that maximum fat burning period, and also a bit about autotrophy as well?
Yeah, so with that sort of 16 hours, you're only just starting to tap into those fat burning sort of areas and that autophagy. So pushing a bit further and getting that 18, 20, 22 hours gives you longer time to reduce insulin. So a lot of these people who are very overweight or diabetic have high insulin resistance, and the body responds a lot better with longer periods of that low insulin and the autophagy. So getting those really good benefits. I say to people, if you stop at 14 hours, you've kind of not fasted, really. You've not achieved much. If you get to 16 hours, you're starting to tap in. But of course, if you need a lot more progress and you need to sort of work on that diabetes, then yeah, I really encourage them to get to to 18 to 20 at least. A lot of it is tricky, and I do find there are some patients I can push harder than others. Some will jump straight into one meal a day. But others, they might do one meal a day for a day and then decide it's too hard and stop altogether. So I'd rather they did 16 hours than none.
Yeah, so for you, Sarah, one meal a day, let's just talk about that for a second. For me, one meal a day is basically like going to a restaurant for me, where I'll have an entree and then I'll have my main a little bit later in my window. And I may finish off with a dessert that day or coffee with some cream in it before I close my window. Is that similar to what you sort of do, or are you more just a sort of a one meal and that's it?
Yeah, no, I'm definitely the restaurant meal. And I think it's good for mental health not to restrict too hard. I think if you're restricting to one plate a day, that can be tricky. Not it's fine if that's what works for you, but I think enjoying a couple of hours where you can have that sort of snack or entree, as you say, have your main meal. And then, yeah, you might finish with a piece of fruit or some yogurt later on, or whatever it is you want to finish with. So, yeah, we're definitely the old restaurant one meal a day over here.
Yeah, so let's just go back a bit to your own journey here with losing the 20 kilos, and I guess you're at maintenance now. You're at your goal weight you want to be, or
Yeah, look, I'm at my goal size. I never had a goal weight. I'm at my goal size. I could probably lose a bit more weight for sure, but I'm happy. I feel good. I'm wearing the size I want to be. So, yeah, I'm fine with where I'm at.
I mean,
Yep.
20 kilos is a fair bit of weight. I could imagine you've gone down a few wardrobes and that sort of thing. And for me, Sarah, one of the biggest drivers was clothing, believe it or not. And I know when I was obese, obesity used to choose my clothing. It used to choose everything I wore, basically. And now I choose it. And it opened up a whole new world for me. I was able to experience going into some label shops and buying lovely clothes and nicer colours. And when you're obese, I think you tend to wear a few drab colours. Was that happening to you too when you were carrying the weight?
Yeah, absolutely. So I used to wear what was comfortable and very black. I wore a lot of black. But actually now I only wear clothes I love. So if I don't love it, I don't buy it. And there's a lot of colour, a lot more colour than it used to be. I wear horizontal stripes, which wasn't ever a feature in my wardrobe 20 kilos ago. Yeah, so absolutely. And I feel really good with what I wear, whereas before it was sort of like, oh, this will do. This is comfortable.
Yeah. So what's your dream, Sarah, with all this? I mean, can you see a time where people that are obese or they're at their wits' end with weight will walk into a doctor's surgery and the doctor will just say to them, here's a prescription, intermittent fast for a year, eat in a window, fast for this long, and out you go. Can you see that ever happening?
Yeah, I mean it happens in my clinic, but the dream is to make redundant the manufacturers of insulin for type 2 diabetes. Of course, our type 1s are going to need insulin, but my dream is that it shouldn't ever really be prescribed for a type 2. And my dream is that we put them out of business in regards to type 2. I think I'd really like to see it go more mainstream, and I'd like to see it get into some of the DHB or the District Health Board clinics. So at the moment, I know that we do a lot of weight loss surgery through the DHB. Weight loss surgery is another whole realm that I really discourage my patients from doing. It doesn't work long term. Yes, you lose the weight, but within 5 years, almost all have put some weight back on. And you're miserable. You can't eat like a normal person. So you can have a tin of tuna on a cracker, but quantity wise, that's about all you can cope with. So, I discourage people from that. And my dream would be to get into those clinics and say, hang on, you don't get to have that surgery unless fasting isn't an option for you. And let's get you fasting first for a year. So,
Yeah, and that sort of was the go-to, wasn't it, for a lot of GPs and specialists that send people off. I had a couple of specialists that say to me, oh, maybe you should just have weight loss surgery. And I thought, well, there's got to be a better way, Like I just thought I had to get rid of my food addictions. And do you treat many people that are actually addicted to food, like sugar and fast food and that sort of thing as well? Because that's a real issue. That's more of a mental issue.
yeah, and I think there is a lady that works, and she's been in touch with me, and she works with fasting, but also the psychology around addiction, because yes, that is a big factor. I almost guarantee a lot of my patients will have some sort of addictions. A lot of them can be to fizzy or to those energy drinks. And that's one of the big things that I notice if they do fast is automatically they're cutting out two or three drinks because they can't have them in their fasting period. So if nothing else changes, they've got rid of half the fizzy, which is really great.
Yeah, what about yourself, Sarah? Did you restrict alcohol at all on the way through, or do you drink alcohol?
Yeah, I mean, I do drink alcohol. I'm not a big drinker and I never have been. So no, I never restricted because I never drank a lot anyway. I'd probably have a couple of wines every 2 or 3 weeks maybe. So no, I didn't restrict alcohol because it wasn't a big factor for me. There are some patients who I sort of say, look, it's probably wise in cutting down because they do drink quite a bit, or probably 5 days a week. And I say, okay, if your progress is slow, let's look at that.
Yeah. I know Kiwis are very sociable people. I was a very sociable person myself. I was a bit of a party animal in my day, Sarah. And I found intermittent fasting, that really to me was the only real downside initially, was that it affected my social life and probably impacted on my wife a fair bit too, because we had a very active social life. And when you sort of telling people, oh, how do you sort of handle social occasions and that type of things, like parties, weddings, that sort of thing, what do you tell them to do?
So, for the most part, I encourage people to try and make it work for their window because I think it's important not to miss out. And I think if you're missing out too often, that would make it hard to sustain your fasting lifestyle. I guess for me, I found it quite easy. Being a mum, I'm often home anyway. So it's not like we're out when I was 20 and out to the pub late at night and all of that. And when we do go out, it's planned in advance because we need a babysitter or we need to make sure the kids have a nap before we go out. So for me, it was quite easy to make my window work because I think, okay, well, on Saturday, I need to eat later. So Friday, I'll stop a bit later, so I could sort of tweak my window. But I talk to people about that. I love Jim Stevens' quote of Saturday's not a special occasion, it happens every week. And I really like that because I think you've got to get some perspective on what a special occasion is. So no, Saturday's not a special occasion, but yes, a wedding or a birthday is. Having said that, I don't think there's ever a special occasion where you need to be eating 12 or 14 hours a day. Even on Christmas Day, I skip breakfast. You're always eating too much at Christmas anyway, so I don't need the croissants first thing in the morning. I can wait for the big dinner.
Yeah, I hear
Yeah. So yeah, no, I just talk to people about trying to make it work for them. If they've got something regular that happens, like a brunch every Sunday morning, make sure you close your window in time so that you get that fast in before brunch.
Well, I think it's really important too to tell people that there is light at the end of the tunnel once you get the weight off. And I find maintaining my weight now, Sarah, for over a year. And when I was losing the weight, my protocol was 23 and 1, 7 days a week, till I got the weight off. And I got 130 pounds off, or 60 odd kilos in that time. And I was pretty rigid on that. And then I sort of started making a bit of a plan about maintenance and how I was going to handle that. But I wanted to reintroduce some sort of social aspect to it. So I moved to a 22 and 2 Monday and Friday. And then I'd do 16 and 8 on the weekend, so I could go and have brunch with my wife and that sort of thing. So, yeah, it is important if you're going to do it long term, and it is a lifestyle that I want to do for the rest of my life. So I had to make a plan where it was going to work for me. Is that something you sort of talk to people about after you get the weight off? What are you going to do then?
Yeah, absolutely. So, the case study I talked about earlier, that my one of my most recent ones, he's just this week, we've stopped all his diabetes medication. So we stopped his insulin in June and we've just stopped all his diabetes medication. So for him, I've talked to him about keeping an eye on those blood sugars. He's going to stick with that one meal a day for another 3 months and then we'll recheck his HbA1c. And then from there, we'll make a plan for maintenance because, of course, what we don't want is to return to normal and have his diabetes come flooding back. So yeah, we do make plans, but for a lot of people, they're really happy with one meal a day or whatever they've got to, and they quite often just stick with that. And that's true for me too. I could probably ease up a little, but actually, I'm really happy doing what I do. So.
Yeah. And what about the mental aspect? I know that that's really important to get people's mindset into the right place. With the clinics doing the intermittent fasting, and is there some sort of component where they get some support around the mental health of it all?
Yeah, so for all of my patients that come through the clinics, I keep a very close eye on them. We sort of touch base fortnightly in the first few months. I don't have a lot of people that are really struggling with their mental sort of side of it. I think the ones that do struggle with that are the ones that also struggle just to get on board in the first place. It's really tricky because in New Zealand it's difficult to get funding for support. The lady I spoke about earlier, who does fasting work as well as psychology work, is great, but a lot of my patients can't afford that. So it's trying to find funding and the right support for these people.
Yeah. So in my case, I was addicted, as I said, to sugar and fast food. So if I was to come to your clinic sort of thing and say, look, I'm a chronic addict to all this and I can't get over it, what sort of would be the treatment there? Would you try to treat the addiction first?
No, I would start the fasting first,
Yep.
because automatically, if you're having a clean fast, you've even though you're still addicted, you've already cut out 2 meals a day where you're not having sugar. So you're already having, say, 20 hours a day where there is no sugar. So I think I'd always start the fasting first. But for that sort of thing, I would refer where possible. But again, a lot of it's private pay. So we really struggle with that here in New Zealand, is finding support for that. One of my clinics has some mental health support, which is really good. And I can send patients that way. But yeah, it's tricky.
And what's your take when people are addicted? In my case, I just quit my addictions cold turkey straight off the bat. Like 40-year addiction, chronic to sugar, 3-4 times a day through a drive-through, and I decided on a 4-hour flight from Sydney to Perth, I was just going to stop. And when I got off that plane, I did stop. And I found that while it was difficult, the hardest part was going through the withdrawal. It was pretty brutal. So how do you think people can overcome addiction longer term, even with intermittent fasting, if they're still addicted to those things?
I think that it can be incredibly difficult. And I think what you did is probably a good way, in the sense that I find that for people who try and wean off these things, sugar and takeaways and things, that actually that's a longer, slower process that often fails. A lot of people who have these addictions and go keto actually manage to get rid of those addictions because they just don't have access or just don't have those foods. And I think you've probably found the same, you know, just by not having them, if you get through that withdrawal, actually the cravings over time become, or the mental cravings over time become less because you don't have constant reminder.
Yeah. What about education around food when you're treating these people? Do you teach them about things like reading nutrition labels and understanding what is in food?
Yeah, no, we do. It sort of depends on the patient. And because, of course, the other factor that I see a little bit of is low levels of education. So a lot of the reason I found in the past people would fail with a traditional diabetes diet was actually they didn't understand the information behind reading labels and all of that. Now, it is very tricky because it's such a big, big area that needs a lot of work on in regards to educating patients. What I tend to do, because I'm limited on time and because I, you know, when I see patients, I've got a certain amount of time to see them in the clinics and then they need to move on so I can see my next patient. So what I tend to do is I talk a little bit more about the foods they should be eating rather than the foods they shouldn't. So we talk about avoiding, fizzy is a big one, and I try and get people off fizzy as soon as I can, especially if they're diabetic. I try and get rid of that. So we get rid of the fizzy, and we talk about eating whole natural foods. So when you go to the supermarket, walking around the outside of the supermarket rather than all the aisles with all the packaged foods, you know, fruits, veggies, meats, proteins, we talk about those sorts of things rather than have a look at the chips, which one has more salt and which doesn't, because I find that can be complicated. But also because I'm limited on time, I just can't go into that sort of depth with a lot of my patients.
Yeah, it is. And well, Sarah, we're just about going to wrap it up, but if you've got any final words of motivation, if somebody's sitting out there and they're really battling, and just tell people how they can connect with you. And if you can avail yourself with your private services.
Yeah, so if they want to sort of have a look at my work and see what I'm up to, they can have a look at intermittentfasting.co.nz is my website, but on Facebook it's NZ Intermittent Fasting, which is Freedom from Diet, so that's the link to my Facebook group. But on my website, intermittentfasting.co.nz, there's a link there. They can flick me a message if they want to and have a look through what I'm doing. But yeah, I think, you know, I was asked recently, is there anyone who shouldn't be fasting? And of course, apart from those, you know, the pregnant woman and breastfeeding woman, frail elderly, I don't like to put on fasting. And of course, your children and teenagers. Or if anyone's had addictions, those people shouldn't be fasting. Eating disorders, so bulimia or anorexia or those kinds of things. you know, fasting's not for them. But apart from those groups, I think everyone should be fasting. I think it's, you know, there's so many benefits well and beyond weight loss and reversal of type 2 diabetes that, you know, I think everyone could benefit from it, really. So, yeah, absolutely jump on.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And thank you so much for the work you're doing, Sarah. It's so refreshing to speak to a medical person that's actually doing something about it and has got into a clinic and talked to the doctors about it. And where can people, are people able to access that presentation you did? Was that only for the doctors?
Yeah, unfortunately, that was only for the doctors, but I am going to look at doing some Facebook Lives. You know, it makes me nervous. I haven't done one before, but I'm looking to do some Facebook Lives where I can do some education and answer some questions and things. So if people want to get involved, they can jump on and join my Facebook group and watch out for those in the next few weeks.
Thank you so much for joining us today on the Fasting Highway. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And thank you, Graham. It was really awesome to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Wow, that was an amazing chat with Sarah. And thank you so much, Sarah, for all the work that you're doing over there in New Zealand. So refreshing to hear a medical person, and with such a great insight into what that's doing, treating these patients with a frontline treatment using intermittent fasting rather than just sending them off for weight loss surgery. I think that's quite incredible. Your own journey is amazing too, and thank you for sharing with us today. So next week, guys, I'm delighted to have a good friend of mine, Jeff Barth, on the podcast. And Jeff is a real-life highwayman. And Jeff is a trucker in America, and he's been keeping America moving these past few months through the pandemic. And Jeff chose to take up fasting a few months ago, and he's had some amazing success. And he's such a great guy, and it's a real story of resilience. So join us next Thursday, and until then, be well, keep safe, and remember, clean fasting is everlasting.